typical to the writer of Kings, his style would be to introduce one king and then kind of cover his entire kingdom, his entire rule, and then go to the next king that started after him. So we will hear a little bit about Jehoshaphat actually before we're formally introduced to him in the writings of 1 Kings, okay? So we are in the reign of Jehoshaphat, and most of what we want to deal with has to do with Ahab. I just said we're in the reign of Jehoshaphat, didn't we? We're in the reign of Ahab. These names are crazy, aren't they? We're in the reign of Ahab. And most of the next 10 chapters or so, we're going to deal with Ahab's reign. This is a very monumental time in Israel's history. Ahab is the son of Omri, who took the throne from Elah. Well, he didn't. Tibni assassinated Elah and tried to rule, but the country didn't like
And at some point during this kingdom, which if I can get this just right, there we go. We've got the whole reign of Ahab, all 22 years of it, here in 1 year. During the reign of Ahab, his wife Jezebel begins to seriously push for full-out Baal worship in the northern kingdom. Under the other two or other couple of dynasties that existed in the northern kingdom, it was still mostly the worship of the golden calves, which they called the worship of Jehovah, but it had been corrupted from its pure biblical form. But now something new is done, and in fact the writer of Kings says as if it were a light thing for Ahab to worship the golden calves. He also brought in the Baals, which are the Canaanite gods. And along with them, another goddess called the Asherah, which were sort of like totem poles in the form of their idol. But they set these things up all over the place to be worshipped. And the worship of Asherah was immoral and sometimes brutal. Gene. Yes, Jezebel was actually a princess of the Sidonians. And her father, we know from other archaeological finds, that her father was the chief priest to Baal in Sidon. And he overthrew the king and established himself as the king. And so Ahab marries this girl who learned a great deal of violence and extreme idolatry from her father. And so she brings that into Israel to the worship there, so much so that Ahab builds a temple for Baal in Samaria. So going to our map, if you recall, the former kings of Israel had mostly dwelt here in Tirzah, but Ahab bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer, and we mentioned that in the Hebrew, Shemer and Samaria look very similar because the vowels were not there. So Shemaria, Shemer. And so he builds his capital here in Samaria, and this is going to continue to be the capital of the northern kingdom from that point all the way until it's destroyed in 722. So as far as years go, we are right around 910 B.C., David established the monarchy of Israel. He became king in about 1040 BC. David ruled for 40 years, Solomon ruled for 40 years, and then Rehoboam, the kingdom split. So we are, if you count Saul in there for 40 years as well, we're almost 200 years after the formation of the monarchy in Israel. So we've come down to 910 BC, and that puts us right around here as far as Ahab's reign goes, okay? But something interesting happens somewhere in there, and we're not given a specific date for it, but onto the scene marches a guy named Elijah, who marches into the throne room in Samaria, and without having been heard of before that we know of, tells King Ahab, it's not going to rain until I say so. God commanded me to come here and tell you that. God very often in the Old Testament uses natural phenomenon like droughts, famines, earthquakes, those sorts of things to try to get the attention of his people, okay? And so he's going to use this as an attention getter for the northern kingdom. You guys are completely abandoning the worship of Jehovah. You're going to worship the Baals. And so there will be no rain until Elijah is satisfied that you've returned to the true worship of God. Well, we read last week that he accomplished that. It didn't rain. He went and was nourished by the ravens for some time. We don't know exactly how long. But then after a period of time, God sent him to Zarephath, which, once again, going back to our map, we noted that Zarephath is up here in the north between Tyre and Sidon. And so there's Zarephath. It's not even an Israelite city, and yet in that place, God brings Elijah to the house of a widow woman who's just about to starve. He miraculously provides for her, miraculously heals her son, and her household is established in the worship of Jehovah. And so here in this this idolatrous pagan nation between Tyre and Sidon, in fact, the very place where Jezebel comes from, God establishes at least one household that is truly worshiping him with Elijah. He did that. So we pick up in chapter 18, the first verse tells us in the... Oh, that's 2 Kings. I'm going to say that name didn't look right. We're supposed to be in 1 Kings 18, by the way. 1 Kings 18. Hey, that looks better. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year. So the first description we get time-wise is that it is after many days. So he has been with this widow woman for quite some time, and it gives us a little bit more of a specific timing and says it's in the third year. That's probably not the third year of the drought. It's the third year that he's been with the widow woman. We actually get more chronological information from the New Testament on this passage, because if you go to James chapter 5, James is making a point about prayer. And he says that, you know, we should be praying for various things like houses selling and relocation of sisters to better living conditions and sick folks. He's making that point in James 5, and he gives us as an example Elijah, who for 3.5 years had a drought on the land. And it specifically says 3 years and 6 months. And so that gives us a much better timing of actually how long the drought lasted. 3 years and 6 months. So in the third year that 1 Kings tells us must be, we're in the third year since Elijah came to the widow woman's house. The drought began quite a time before that because he was fed by the ravens for a period of time. So that puts us, maybe he was fed by the ravens for a year or so, and now he's been over 2 years at this widow woman's house, and we're into the third year. And so it's finally at this point that God says, all right, it's time. Israel is ripe for what I want to do here. And he tells Elijah, go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. Now, we have to use our sanctified imaginations here for just a little bit. What's the longest drought you've ever seen? 2 or 3 months? Okay. How bad was the crop that year? Didn't go too badly, did it? Okay, 40 bushels an acre for corn. That's pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Eldon?
In 2012, my farm, and my brother's farm, my corn was kind of frozen, got off to a good start. Months ago, but it was right at the worst time. And my brother's corn made 0 bushels an acre. He combined whole fields and didn't get a bushel.
Really?
And my corn, some of the best corn in the area, it made 16 bushels an acre.
How many of you in here knew that Eldon bought the farm? You look really well.
My farm is very small. It's
only
30 acres.
Uh-huh, yep. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You just celebrated a 50th wedding anniversary. Uh-huh. Okay.
About 51.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Carolyn, did you know you married a guy that bought the farm?
Yeah. Sure.
Sure. Gene. Yeah. Yeah, and I wish I had some statistics on that. Yeah, and it was a bad time. It was really bad. I don't know how long that went on, but it was pretty rough. So we have a couple of testimonies in living memory here of just 2 months drought. And in one case, it didn't do too bad. And in another case, it ruined everything. So you have to sort of put yourself in this position without all of the modern farming equipment. Because remember, when they're planting fields back here, they're not planting them anywhere near as densely as we do. You're talking about just hand scattering the wheat. So it's not placed as evenly as we place it so that each kernel can get just the right amount of moisture and dirt. And their yields were already much, much lower. But then on top of that, your first season, you go out and plant and no rain at all comes. So how's that yield going to go? Not very well. And then you go out the next season and say, well, I got to plant something. So you scrounge up some seed somewhere and you plant your fields again. And no rain again the second year. Same thing the third year. But how many years did this go on? 3.5. So we may be well into the fourth growing season without a single drop of rain. So how long can the ground hold on to moisture when it hasn't rained in 3.5 years? Yeah. Yes, there was. Yep. Eldon?
After 3.5 years, you probably your trees, most of your trees would die.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have. And the only thing that might produce might be some of your vineyards might produce some grapes because grapevines, real old vines, they go pretty deep.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And they said that whether it rains or whether it doesn't rain, they still get grapes.
Okay. Just smaller ones. Sour, huh? Well, that's the situation they're in here. 3.5 years. So yeah, we're probably in our fourth growing season without any rain. And finally, God appears to, or doesn't appear to, the word of the Lord comes to Elijah and says, go show yourself to Ahab and I'll bring rain upon the earth. So remember too, who is Baal? In their conception, who is he? He's the storm god. And now for 3.5 years, there have been no storms in Israel. God is making a definitive statement about who is actually in control of the world. It's not Baal. It's Jehovah. So it's time to make this point in a verbal way. He's made it with nature. He's made it in the water cycle. Now it's time to point out to everybody what the problem is, because don't ever underestimate the stupidity of man to not get the point, right? We don't always get the point when God tries to make it. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab, and now the famine was severe in Samaria. So we come back south here. Elijah's traveling southward through the area of Tyre. He comes through Galilee, and then he's got to pass through the valley of Jezreel before he can climb up into the mountains into Samaria. Well, he's not even going to get all the way to Samaria because the famine is severe in Samaria. It's getting bad, and it's getting so bad verse 3, that Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now, he's going to give Obadiah his plan here, which relates to how bad the famine has become. Because there's no water, there's no food. And the king has to have some solution to this. So he's going to call Obadiah with his solution to this problem. But before we get to the solution, we have to be introduced into who is Obadiah and why is the king calling him. Okay? Obadiah, who was over the household. This means that Obadiah is Ahab's chief servant. He's the one that pretty much manages the kingdom. He manages all of Ahab's affairs, okay? So he makes sure the house is running. He makes sure all the other servants are provided for. He makes sure that Ahab doesn't have to worry about anything that's going on at home so that Ahab can be busy running the kingdom. So he must be somebody that Ahab trusts very, very well. I mean, who would you put in charge of everything in your house? Mom, exactly. Exactly. You know, we read a few years ago this fun book, and it talked about two different types of people. It said there's neaties, not needies, there's neaties, N-E-A-T-I-E-S, like they keep things neat, and there's messies. I'll leave you to guess which is which in our household. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. Here's another very important piece of information about this household. So, think for a moment about the character of Ahab. What kind of guy is he? Not a God-fearer, right? He brings Baal worship into the kingdom. He's married to Jezebel. Probably he's getting pushed around quite a bit by this gal, because that seems to be her nature, right? And so you'd have to wonder who's actually calling the shots there in the house of Obadiah. But technically speaking, the house of Ahab. Technically speaking, Obadiah would be overseeing the house, and that would mean overseeing Jezebel. Now, Jezebel's bringing Baal worship into the kingdom, but now we know this little tidbit about Obadiah. He's a God-fearing man. He fears the Lord greatly. He wants to do what's right. And we're going to see how that worked out in one instance in his life. Verse 4, when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord. Now, there's a little tidbit we hadn't heard about yet. Not only has Ahab allowed Jezebel to massively push Baal worship into the kingdom of Israel, but she's also completely trying to obliterate the true worship of God because she went on a campaign and killed the prophets of the Lord. So she's trying to completely exterminate the light of God's word in northern Israel so that she can have her way as it comes to Baal worship and the Asherah worship. Right? That's something we had not read about yet. Here's an amazing thing about how God intervenes on behalf of his people. He uses tools to do it. So while Jezebel is on this crusade to cut off the prophets of the Lord, meaning to try to wipe them out, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water. This is fascinating stuff. This would make a great movie, wouldn't it? I mean, talk about the intrigue. How does Obadiah do this without letting Jezebel know that he's doing it? Because if she's going around the kingdom ordering the prophets of the Lord to be killed, what's she going to do to the servant of the house when she finds out he's the one protecting them? It's a good plot, isn't it? I think that'd be good stuff. Eldon, you'll have to check and see if that company you were talking about made any movies about this. Go ahead. Ah. Oh, so we're double whammying the teenagers.
That's right. And they might be able to tell you a few things. I don't know.
That'd be good.
anyway, what happens is that how many prophets was there in the caves?
It says he's hit them by 50, so there's 100 of them.
100 of them.
Mm-hmm.
You try to carry enough food to feed people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't be. It would be a tough thing for him to feed these guys. Now, we don't know how long he's been feeding them, but apparently it's been going on for a little while. And like Eldon says, how does Obadiah sneak enough food out of the house? And by the way, who's paying for all that? Jezebel's paying for it, or Ahab, right? Well, we can presume that as the master of the house, as it were, Obadiah, the head of the household, is kind of silently pushing off some funding over here, little earmarks, in the spending bills. You know, maybe Jezebel's starting to say, you mean the cost of butter went up to $48 a pound? I say, well, there's a famine on right now, so, well, okay. Go ahead, Kathy. Yeah, so he's got access to it somewhere, right? That could be, yeah, Eldon.
Well, what about Judah? Did they have
the
droughts, or did they get rain?
You know, it doesn't mention. We're not sure if they got caught up in this or not.
It might be a case where they were buying them across the border.
It very well could be. They're importing a lot of things, right? And so we know this. It's all about in the news. What happens when you have to import large amounts of food? What happens to your economy? Things start to go down. Why is that? Because you're importing consumable goods like food, and you're exporting all of your wealth. That's why we don't like to have big import deficits. We don't like to be importing more than we're exporting, because it means we are slowly draining the wealth of our nation and giving it to other places. We'd rather it be at least balanced. We'd really rather it to be the other way around, right? Well, Israel's not in that point, because who's in control of the fates of nations and kings? God is. Okay. Federal Reserve, do whatever sly things you think you can do with the money supply. It won't help. God is in control. He will do what he's going to do, right? And that's not trying to make any specific thing about raising or lowering the rates, by the way. I'm just making a point. God is in control. Well, Obadiah is supplying these prophets, probably from the funding that he gets from Ahab to feed the household, all while Jezebel is trying to wipe out the prophets of the Lord. He hides them in a cave by 50s and feeds them with bread and water. And that's a good point, Kathy. Where is he getting the bread and water? Well, as the king, he probably had access, or as the king's servant, he would have had access to whatever the country had left. And so we get back in verse 5 to Ahab's plan to try to save the kingdom. And that was introduced back in verse 3 when he called Obadiah. So now we know a little bit about Obadiah's character. He's obviously a man of great courage, because he is completely defying the king and the queen and their wishes about things. Incidentally, this is a great example of when a government asks you to do what is wrong, what do you do? Here's a great example of a guy that refused, and not only refused to do what was wrong, but insisted on doing what was right. Now, Obadiah is a great example to us. So what happens when your government asks you to do something that you know is not what God wants you to do? Are we as Christians, because of Romans 13:1, obey all those that have authority over you? Do we have to do everything our government tells us to do? No, we don't. So when the government says, destroy the prophets of the Lord, what do? You hide them in the basement, right? I don't know if that'll ever happen. Maybe you guys will have to hide me in a closet somewhere, right? And they'll say, I don't know, I've seen Pastor Brian eat bread. Right. Back to Ahab's plan. Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals. So here's his plan. It's a last-ditch, desperate measure. We've got to scour the countryside looking for every drop of water we can find and any blade of grass that's still growing. Amazingly enough, there are some plants that still seem to grow when there's no water, and I think every one of them lives in my garden. And they don't produce eatable food, right? Except to maybe mules that can eat anything. But that's his plan. We got to scour the countryside. So if we're starting in Samaria, which is somewhat close to middle as far as north-south goes for northern Israel, one of them's going to go down here, one of them's going to come up this way. We are looking for any drop of water, any clustering of grass. What's the point? We want to take the royal herd there so that hopefully we can feed them for a little bit longer and not have to start slaughtering animals. And you say, well, why don't you slaughter animals and eat them? Well, because you can only slaughter animals so long before your herd runs out, right? And at the rate they're going, especially when Ahab's looking at the lists and saying, boy, it looks like we're feeding 600 men, but there's only 500 in the castle. I don't understand what's happening. Everybody's supposed to be on half rations during this thing. But we want to try to save the horses, the mules, and maybe not lose some of the animals. So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Now, just myself, I'm thinking that probably they have some servants going with them. It's not just Obadiah on a horse and Ahab on a separate horse. Probably they have an escort. It's possible they didn't do it the other way, but Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And so again, I don't think that necessarily means all alone with nobody else, because the king probably would not be traveling unattended in any way. He'd probably have some kind of escort of people. But the point is, you have the king and his most trusted servant scouring the land looking for the last vestiges of water and food for the country. That tells you you're in a pretty desperate situation. That also tells you that this country ought to be ripe to receive a message from God. So verse 7, as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. Now where's Elijah been? Yeah, with the widow way up in Zarephath, up here off the screen. Not even in Israel. Now, we get a little picture here of what's been going on in the royal court. Obadiah recognized him, fell on his face, and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" Somehow, I mean, he must have been in the courtroom when Elijah came in the first time, and so he recognizes him. But he can't believe it's actually Elijah because he's been gone for 3.5 years. For a year or so, he stayed by the ravens, or stayed by the brook, and the ravens fed him, and then he went to the widow's house. So he hasn't been seen in Israel for 3.5 years. "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go, tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." Verse 9, most of us would think, oh, good. Finally. I mean, what do we know about Obadiah? What was the first thing it told us about him? He feared the Lord greatly, so don't you think he'd be happy to see Elijah, God's messenger? And he comes in and says, "I want you to go talk to Elijah." That probably means the drought's about to come to an end, because Elijah's come back. But I love how Obadiah responds here in verse 9, because I am guessing that many of us, or most of us, have at some point in time felt this way. "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? What did I do?" Now you got to think about why he responds this way. He's going to explain it a little bit here, but Obadiah, faithful guy or not faithful guy? Faithful guy in the face of extreme danger to himself. He's been hiding these prophets of the Lord in the cave. So you got to imagine, here's yourself. You have been doing what God wanted you to do, and it's been terrifying you, nerve-wracking you, stressing the daylights out of you for quite a while now, and then God appears and asks you to do like the thing you thought would be the most horrible thing in the world to do. Sometimes, once you've learned one lesson, God takes you on to the next one that He's been preparing you for. And here, I think Obadiah is not only a great example of how to handle an unrighteous government, I think he's a great example of understanding that God will never be done with you, right? You can never come to a point where you say, "Haven't I done enough? Wasn't that last trial the worst thing I could have gone through and I succeeded? Why are you bringing me into this one?" Now we want to explain a little bit about why he thinks that this is going to be a trial. We would probably just naturally say, "Good. Elijah's going to go and confront Ahab. He's going to repent, hopefully, and the nation's going to turn around, and God's going to give us rain." But look at the reasoning here. And I think this is the kind of reasoning that can only come from somebody that has been enduring extreme stress for a very long time. He's afraid. He's faithful, but he's fearful. "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you." Remember, Obadiah, as a trusted servant, has had access to Ahab and what's been going on in the royal court for the last 3.5 years. And so he knows Ahab has been scouring the nations looking for Elijah. What do you think he wants with Elijah? Either off with his head, or how much money do I have to give you to make it rain again? Ahab, you got to think of it this way. Ahab has surrounded himself with the prophets of Baal. He lives day in and day out with that woman Jezebel, who's not exactly a biblical example of godly wifehood, right? He probably has rarely, if ever, encountered what we would call a righteous prophet. And so most of the prophets of Baal will prophesy to you whatever you want them to say. If they think it should be good, they'll tell you it's good. And probably the more you pay them, the better odds that you're going to get a good message from them. Right? So there's two things I think that he's looking for Elijah for. Either he wants to bring him in and say, look, you better make it rain or off with your head. Or, look, what can I give you to make you beseech the Lord on our behalf? Because understand that almost all the time when you abandon biblical truth, your conception of God begins to boil down to a God who wants favors from you in order to give you what you want. A genie. Rub the lamp, he'll give you what you want, as long as you perform the right sacrifices. And so Ahab, surrounded by the prophets of Baal, has probably come to the point where he thinks that Jehovah can be bought or convinced. And neither of those is a biblical conception of God. He's the God who rules over heaven and earth. He's a God like no other. He's a God beyond our understanding. He's a God who does according to the counsel of his own will. How often does God ask you what you would like to have happen in your life before he does it? Never. So that's the God Ahab's dealing with, and he doesn't realize it. And so Obadiah tells Elijah, look, we've been searching everywhere. We have sent emissaries to foreign countries looking for you. And when they would say he is not here, he would take an oath of that kingdom or nation that they had not found you. So Ahab has even gone to the lengths of getting oaths from other kings saying, we've searched for Elijah, he isn't here. Extradition laws and all. Right? We can't find him. Now, irony of ironies, Elijah has been hiding out in Ahab's wife's old stomping grounds. Isn't that fun? God loves good irony, I think. I'm convinced of it. God has a sense of humor. So, we've been looking everywhere, verse 11, and now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. In other words, we've been looking everywhere, nobody can find you. Why should I tell him you're standing right here in the middle of Israel? As soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he'll kill me, although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. So last time Elijah was on the scene, he came in, he preached the message before Ahab, and then he disappeared for 3.5 years. Nobody could find him. So Obadiah is afraid that God will do the same thing here. He says, I'm going to go get Ahab, and I'm going to come back here, and by the time I get here, God is going to have swept you off somewhere, and I'll have no idea, and Ahab will kill me. God, haven't I done enough for you? Don't put me at risk again. Ever felt that way? Well, God gives him a promise here. Oh, sorry, verse 13. I'm jumping ahead of myself, aren't I? Obadiah's got a few more things he wants to say. Has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your Lord Elijah is here? He will kill me. At what point have we been faithful enough that we can say, I don't want to risk any more for him? Never. How faithful was he to death? Just studied that the last 2 weeks, haven't we? He became obedient, even to the point of death. And here's poor Obadiah, and we can all understand it because we all have a heart like that. He's terrified. He's been stressing his terrified heart for 3 years, even doing what's right, but it's been scaring the daylights out of him. And this feels like one step too far. And so God has to reassure him here through Elijah. Verse 15, he swears this oath, "As the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." And so once Obadiah has that assurance, okay, God's intentions are not to destroy him. Have you ever felt like that? God's just trying to destroy me. That's all he's out to do. I don't know what I did. I must have done something wrong. And he just wants to smush me. And he's going to accomplish it. But that's not so. So Elijah gives him this oath. I'm going to be here. And so Obadiah, a faithful man but a fearful one, he went to meet Ahab and told him. And Ahab went to meet Elijah. And we'll cover the confrontation next time we get together on Sunday night. A confrontation, probably a well-known one, between the prophets of Baal and Elijah on top of Mount Carmel. It's another fun story that makes a great movie. And there's, if you want to think God has a sense of humor, then come back for that one. We have some fun things to talk about when it comes to that. Eldon.
Yeah.
Sunday morning? Oh, that's right. Next year, that's right. You got to wait till next year to hear this. We won't have an evening service next week, and we won't have an evening service the week after that. So Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, there's no evening services. So yeah, January 1st, same bat time, same bat channel, sort of same bat time.
7th.
What did I say? Yeah, not 1st. That's a Monday. 7th. Okay. Any questions?